The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Me, myself, and I. What I am seeking to do is reorient yourself to a new way of sensing your relationship to God, where your relationship to God is not like your relationship to people, who are relating externally, but rather my relationship to God is an internal relationship between myself and the higher self, the greater self, which is Hashem, right? And now the soul is really a spark of that I am, and that I brought in the Piatzetzner Rebbe that said that. It was seemed like a very, very meek sentence that was thrown in the midst of some little article, but it was a very critical thing to say. Obviously, it was just obvious to him that our I is a spark of the great I. And how we've had experiences of inspiration whereby we feel possessed by a greater spirit that works through us. And that really our little I lies between two different choices for identification. There's the me, which is my persona, my character, my time, my space, David Aaron, red hair, 5 kids, lives in Jerusalem, is a rabbi. That's the character. Okay? That's the character. But the I, the self, the soul, which is animating that character, the true actor, the knowing subject. The character is the knowledge. The character is what I know. But the knowing subject, the I, which cannot be described by any of these characteristics, it's unknowable because it is the knowing, right? It is the I. That I is in a dilemma. I don't use the word trapped. It's not trapped. But it's, let's say, for now, it's almost suspended between two choices, between two poles. Either the I will find its sense of value in identifying with the me, the character, right? Or the I will find its value in identifying with the I, the greater I, the divine I, God, am your God. Okay? And so if the I, the little I, seeks to find its value in the me, in the persona, so if I'm rich, then I am rich. If I lose my wealth, I lose myself with my wealth. Right? This is a story about a fellow who died. Well, actually, before he died, he made an agreement with his friend that he would be buried with all his wealth. That was the deal. And his friend said, yes, I promise I will bury you with all your wealth. Alright? Well, another friend thought, are you crazy? Are you really going to commit to something like that? Said, if I made a commitment, I made a commitment. Well, sure enough, the guy dies. And now comes the time to go take out the cash from the bank and start filling his coffin with, you know, bills and bills and bills. So the funeral comes and the other friend notices that the fellow who had committed is doing nothing about this. And he says, well, where's all the money? I kind of expected, you know, wheelbarrows full of money that you would dump into the coffin and surround him. He said, no, I've got it all worked out. What he did is he opened up his checkbook and he wrote a check for $3 million to the deceased, and he put it in his coffin, and he took the money. He said, I'm good for it. In other words, can you really be buried with your wealth? What can you say? And there's a fellow in, there's a famous grave in Los Angeles, I was told. I cannot say that I have been motivated to visit it. And this guy was buried in his Rolls Royce. Literally. Right? He was buried in his Rolls Royce. That's what he asked to be buried in. And so they buried him in his Rolls Royce. Okay. If you are seeking a sense of self from your persona, You have basically invested in something very transient. Because your persona is transient. It's temporal. It's here today, it could be gone tomorrow. And that's just the way it goes. Right? And that's why death is so shocking to people. You know? How can somebody who was yesterday, you know, a few days ago was the head of the government involved in international relations, right? Moving the world. How could he be just gunned down by some kid, you know, like that? It's shocking to us. It's shocking to us because we see how the persona can be wiped out in seconds. And that's the end of it. So then what happens to the self? Does the self die with the persona? Well, that's really your choice, depending on your life. Whether in your life you choose to make your persona, your body, your career, your skills, which all belong to the category of persona, if you make that the source of your identity, the source of your sense of value. The Kabbalah talks about when a person dies, we're all going to be at our funeral. Right? You will be at your funeral. Of course you will, because you are the honor, the guest of honor. But besides that, right, not only will you be there in body, but you will also be there in soul. There's an aspect of soul, of consciousness, that remains during the Shiva, during the 7 days, during the burial. You're going to be there. You're going to hear what people say. Right? You might hear some people say, "Ha! The old bag finally left us. Let's divide the booty." That's going to hurt, right? That's going to hurt. On the other hand, you might hear people say things that were really true. You might hear things that people say that are not true, and you know they're not true, and that's going to hurt. Well, the Kabbalah says that worms to the side of the deceased is like pins and needles. Talking about worms. What are you talking about? Well, the Kabbalah teaches that we see our bodies being lowered into our grave. We're there. We see that. And it all depends on how you lived your life. Because how you lived your life will determine what that experience will be. It'll either be an absolutely horrifying experience, because you so identified with your body, you so much thought you are a body rather than you have a body, right? It'll be a horrible experience if somehow your whole sense of self was based on your body and everybody said, "Oh, you're great because you had this big body and you were just, you know," and that was really what made you feel really good. It's like I went to, I wanted to go to do some exercise, and I figured the best thing is I put myself in an environment, so I went to one of these gyms in town, and I didn't exactly know what they do there. It turns out that it's more than I was looking for, something more in terms of aerobic type of exercise in terms of respiratory and heart and all that, but this is a bodybuilding place, and the guy's trying to explain to me, you know, and I walk in there, see these guys, you know, pumping this stuff, you know, and when you walk in there, the whole place is mirrors, and all these guys are doing is looking at themselves the whole time. Okay? And they've got like these, I don't know what that is anymore. It's this huge, you know, huge muscles coming out of every part of them. And so I met with the guy who owns the place, and I said, "Well, why would I do this? Right? Why would I want to spend my time doing this? Like, why do I get out of it?" And he said to me, "Hey, listen, man. You know, when I was a teenager, I was a real scrawny, skinny guy. You know? And I had no confidence. No confidence. And that's what happened. I went into bodybuilding, and you should see this guy's physique, you know. And since then, man, I got confidence, you know. Because when you walk out of here after you've worked out, and you walk down Ben Yehuda, and you're all puffed up, man, they're looking at you, man. You know, and you're going to feel real good." Well, I looked at him like, I'm a rabbi. This is not, I'm not looking to do that. It was like very interesting. That's the source of this guy's self. He had said he had a weak sense of self, and his solution was to build his body. And he now thinks he has a strong sense of self. And I really don't believe he does. I think right now he must feel it. But as he sees his body begin to deteriorate with time, you know, as he faces death in whatever way he needs to face it with, God forbid, relatives or friends, he's going to wonder about his body. You know? And so depending on how one lives their lives, if they see their body as the source of their identity, well, then that's going to be really shocking. Really shocking. If they see their body like they saw their car, you know, I like it, I take care of it, it's very important, but I'm not my car. Would anybody think they are their car? Yes, they would. There are people who are not only they are their body, but they are their car. If God forbid you would mistakenly scratch it just a little bit, they would feel it. They would say, ouch, because that car is them. They are their car. And you've seen people like that, I'm sure. Right? So, you know, when you see your car in wreck, that's also going to be shocking. But now we're talking about a person who transcends their body, has absolute love for their body, respect for their body, but does not think that their body is the source of self. Right? Okay. So this is the dilemma that the soul has. The self, the I-ness. The I either seeks value through its persona, or it seeks value through anchoring itself, identifying itself with the greater I, which is Hashem. Okay? And I, a spark of that infinite flame, yearns to just reconnect to that. That's really the definition of religion. What does religion literally mean? Religios. Right? It's Latin. Ligios means what? From the word legion. What's a legion? It's a bond. Right? That's what a ligios means. It's to bond. Re is to do it again. Religios is to rebond myself or rebind myself. I don't know English. With the source. Right? That's really what a religion should be doing. That's really what it should be doing. And so, the self is seeking identity. And identity is through a process called identification. That's what identity is. Right? I identify with my money. If money has value, right? If money has value, then I have value because I'm identified with money. And this world, since money is so valuable, if people identify with money, they feel they're very valuable. Right? Follow this? The interesting thing about Abraham, it says that when God blessed Abraham, said, and I will make you a blessing, there's a midrash that says it means that they will mint money after you. The midrash says that in his time, he was so famous that they put a symbol of him on the money. What does that mean? It means that he gave money value. Because people identified money with what that man does. And therefore it's valuable. Because that man does kindness. That man does tzedakah, charity. And if that's what you can do with money, you can serve the great I, you can serve Hashem with that money, wow! Then that is really something valuable. You got the point? So it's interesting where most people are trying to find identification through identify with money. In the ancient time, the Midrash is saying that money became value because it was identified with Abraham, and that's because Abraham was identified with God. Because his whole life he sought identification with God, and that was his source of identity. Okay. So with all that, what I want you to do is I want you to look at the bottom of this page over here in this column here, and this is something from Rav Aryeh Kaplan. Okay. Yes.
I'm sure I missed this, so I know we discussed it.
What is
the Zohar?
The Zohar. The Zohar is part of our tradition. It's like the Talmud is part of our tradition. It is the oral tradition regarding the Kabbalah. Right? The Kabbalistic understanding of Judaism, which is the mystical, metaphysical understanding of Judaism. Okay? So if you look in the Zohar, it's generally relating to those kinds of issues. The Talmud is generally relating to legalistic issues. Okay? I was among the exiles. You see that? This is from Prophet Yechezkel. The Zohar comments that Yechezkel's eye, or the midah, the attribute, the characteristic that represents his eye, was in exile. Now this is very interesting. Yechezkel says, I was among the exile. The Zohar says that when Yechezkel says, I was among the exile, it has a double meaning. It's little I, as personal me, but it's the great I, is somehow participating in my exile. So the Zohar says that the I represents the characteristic, it comments that Yechezkel's I, or the attribute that represents I, was in exile. What is that? As we've seen, the idea of the Ani usually refers to the sphere of Malchut. What is the sphere of Malchut? It's the attribute of sovereignty, which is one of the attributes of God. Okay? One of the attributes of God is the I, and I know that through an internal voyage, so to speak. It's the source of my little I. Also known as the Shekhinah, the divine presence dwelling in each person. In other words, there is a divine presence dwelling in each and every one of us. And that is the I. Okay? That is the I. And that's why we intuit immortality. We somehow intuit that life will go on for me in some way. When Yechezkel says that his eye is in exile, this is an exact parallel to the exile of the Shekhinah. In other words, when Yechezkel says that his eye is in exile, then it's not just his eye, but there's something divine in exile. What is that? Meditatively, the Ani, which is the eye, is the core of our being and our true self. In fact, what are we doing when we're meditating? And he's talking about meditation in this particular place, but it's true with all the mitzvot. One of the most important goals of meditation, and I add here all mitzvot, is to become one with our essence, to feel the divine within us. In order to do this, we must learn to gently push away all the extraneous mental images and thoughts that fill our minds. As we said, this is essential. This is essentially a process of disengaging. This is very important. I would underline this. A process of disengaging our inner self from its outer trappings. When we then penetrate to the essence of our being, we expect to find the true self. We're trying to get in touch with the knowing self, the I. But the I becomes what it thinks, and it's hard to distinguish the thought from the thinker. Right? If I'm thinking anger, I assume anger. But I'm not anger, I'm just thinking anger. Remember I mentioned to you before, has there been times where you're furiously angry and you're just so on top of what you're doing at the same time and like there's a little voice going inside like, why are you doing this? Right? Or are there times where you're crying your eyes out and you're both in the pain and you're somehow watching it and knowing that I'm going to move out of this, I'm not going to collapse, I'm not going to freak out, I'm going to get by this. Right? Have you experienced this paradox where you're totally in it and yet out of it? That's a moment where you realize that the I does not become what it's thinking. Right? If I were to become what I'm thinking, it would be terrible. Right? But somehow there is this distinction between the knowing subject and the knowledge. But because the knowledge and the knowing subject seem to be so connected, we forget about the knowing subject. So there's a meditation that the Pietzner Rebbe talks about, which he calls inner silence. And the way it starts off is by simply watching, observing your thoughts. You don't try to think of anything. You just let your mind go and you just watch your thoughts. And almost step back in the meditation and watch your thoughts. And what you're going to discover, he says, is how bombarded your mind is with thoughts. And he says the only difference between you and a madman is that a madman actually goes ahead with his thoughts. Right? But in terms of the thoughts, we have insane thoughts that are bombarding us, and you just gotta watch the stream of thoughts go by and don't get caught up in the stream. Right? And that's a beginning of sensing the I, the knowing subject, cannot and should not become trapped into its thoughts. Right? He then says that the next part of the meditation is to meditate on a verse. And that would be the next step. Now that I've kind of disengaged from my persona, the thoughts, I've kind of gotten in touch with myself as the thinker, the thinking center, I now meditate on a verse which will be a way to connect to the I, Hashem, the higher self. Anyways, let's just give you an example of how this works. So, essentially, the process of disengaging our inner self from its outer trappings. How does one do this? Well, we'll look at it in a second in another piece from a psychology book. Alright? When we penetrate to the essence of our being, I'll tell you, there's one student that I had who was part of this therapy called the Diamond Therapy. And what they do in this therapy, the way she described it, is a person sits across from you and says, "Who are you?" You say, "David Aaron." "Who are you?" "I'm a rabbi." "Who are you?" "I'm a father." "Who are you?" They do this for a couple hours. And you begin to get in touch with I. Because you start to say, you know, when you say, "I'm David Aaron," "I'm a father," "I'm this," you start to lose all these definitions and almost forces you to get in touch with the I that has no definition. Right? And you begin to sense a distinction when you answer and you even hear your answer. There's almost a slight surprise. Like, am I a rabbi? I mean, that's what I do. Is that really who I am? Right? So it might be a powerful thing if you're ever bored and you're just sitting across from someone on a bus and say, "Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Who are you?" See how long he'll stay on the bus with you. Alright? And then charge him for your therapy. Alright. I hope I've helped you. Right? Yet is this always true? Does one always find the ani after stripping everything away? See, that's the problem. There could be emptiness. That's the frightening thing. I've had people who do Israelite. And you know, Friday night, I intentionally want it to be a darker room. Because I don't want people to be self-conscious. You know, when you're big light, so you feel people looking at you. And when you think people looking at you, you don't behave because you behave for their sake, but you're not kind of like letting go. So I often, you know, I try to make the room dim. I used to fight with Israelites because it was so dark. They couldn't read the Birkat HaMazon, so I compromised and made it a little less dark. But the darkness helps. And I found that there's certain people who are frightened to close their eyes. You know, I mean, what do you care? We're closing their eyes. They notice the rabbi's closing their eyes. No, he's not falling asleep. Rabbi's closing them. Other people in the room seem to be closing their eyes. And I see people like sitting there, their eyes wide open, like, what will happen to me if I close my eyes? I mean, what will happen? People are really frightened. They can be frightened of closing their eyes. Because closing one's eyes is letting go to a certain extent. It's one of the reasons why people have a problem sleeping. You know, you have to have a lot of trust to go to sleep, that you're going to wake up. Right? And if you're a real controlled person, it might be very hard to go to sleep because you're so in touch, you're so controlling your situation. Well, just let go and fall asleep. Who knows? You know? In camp, we used to take the guy's hand and put it in water, you know? Cause the guy to urinate in the middle of the night. You know, like, someone's going to do that to me? Okay, when you're in camp, listen. It's not camp anymore. There's much more devious things we could do to you. But, you know, can I really trust? Can I really trust and let go and go to sleep? Sleep is surrender. Sleep is definitely surrender. And closing one's eyes is surrender. So I remember one guy, I was talking about this, and he said, "Well, I don't see the point of closing my eyes, because when I close my eyes, all I see is nothing." And I said, "That's the point. You know, we're so involved with seeing, we lose touch with the seer. And so you close your eyes. You watch all the interesting patterns on your television set. And you try and let go. So what happens is a person is afraid. What if I disengage?" Now, I was really impressed. I learned this article with Goldie Hawn. Before I even got to this point, she said, "You know what, Rabbi? I've often thought, who would I be if I didn't have this house? And you should see her house." Wow. I mean, she built this house, she designed it, and it is really stunning. You feel like you've walked into a world, you know, not a house. It's really something else. And she said, I wonder who I'd be if I didn't have this house, if I didn't have my career, if I didn't have, you know. She said, "I really don't think it would make a difference to me." Now, if that's true, then she's on a very high level. You know, it might be true. I have no reason to doubt it's true. So I took her house. Just to check. People afraid they'll be left with nothing. You know? People afraid that they're left with nothing. Because that's become the source of their identity. So when people do this disengaging from the outer trappings, my character, my money, my career, my property, my car, my clothing, my friends are part of my outer trapping too. But I didn't have any of that. Would I still be I? And what happens is that when one, so to speak, strips themselves of everything, they could end up with emptiness. There's a powerful scene in Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Really gave me chills. He's talking about the lineup and the selection and how they just, you walk into this room and there's this man, you're in a line, and there's this German with holding up his hand by the elbow with one finger as he just points left, right, left, right. In other words, which line do you go into as you're coming out of the train? Left, right, you know. That one man's little finger determined whether you're going straight to the gas chambers or whether you're going to go to work. And he said, and so I went to the left or whatever was right. And he was put into a room and they said, strip! Take everything off! People frantically started taking off. They had, I think, a certain amount of time that they even could do it. Otherwise, they'd be lashed. Right? And all of a sudden, these people are stripping everything. Everything. You know, throwing it into a pile. And he said, and there we were with our naked selves. Our naked selves. And he said, and I had this one thing that I was holding on to. It was my manuscript. It was my life manuscript. Everything that I've been working on in psychology and I've been developing and I've written, and I had this little sash with my papers in it. And I was holding on to it. And he came up to me, the German officer came up to me and he said to me, throw it into the pile! Right? Throw it into the pile! And he says, no, you don't understand. This is my work. This is my life work. These are just meaningless papers. It's nothing. It's just my work and some of my things that I've been doing in experimentation. And the guy was listening to him very carefully. And then he looked at him and he said, excuse my language, he said, shit. And he said, throw it in the pile. And he threw it into his pile. Excuse my language, but you need to hear that, you know? Because imagine if someone would say that to you, right? Say that to you. That was your life, your career, everything. Throw it into the pile. And he threw it into the pile. And that was it, he said. Naked existence. All I was is that I was. All I am is that I am. And imagine the tragedy, but imagine the spiritual growth that was invested in the Jews that they had to go through such a thing. Painful. But sometimes these very painful experiences have given us tremendous spiritual elevations. And he talks about that, how people were remarkably very spiritual in the concentration camps. He talks about how really the more religious, spiritually oriented, mind-thinking types lasted longer. The ones with the big bodies and the physiques, they're the ones that broke down. But the ones who could still be in their mind, could still be in their ideals, could still be... it was the weak, frail ones, but the more intellectually, spiritually oriented ones that really made it. And he says, and this really blew me away, that when they started giving out the concentration camp uniforms, and you know that this uniform is something that you've inherited from someone who just died in the death camp, in a gas chamber. And there you're given this torn, dirty, I assume it was dirty, prison uniform. And so he put it on, and he reached into his pocket, and there was this little tiny piece of paper in it. And he took it out, and he looked, and it was Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Some Jew had just a little piece of a siddur, of a prayer book. And he said, maybe that was my exchange. I gave up my life work, and I got the Shema. gives me chills, right? Gives me chills. Who am I, anyways? You know? Who are you? And so a person's afraid I might be nothing if I let go of my clothes, if I let go of my persona, I'll be nothing. And if that's what I think, then death haunts me daily. Daily. Because I know it's all going to go. I just know it's all going to go. And so what happens is, if a person has always defined himself totally in terms of others, meaning other things, other people, then he is not at all his own person. That's it, you're not your own person. I do it because this person, because I want acceptance, I want them to like me, I want them to think I'm this. Who am I? His I could be in exile. That's exactly the point. My I is in exile. My I is in the disco. My I is in the business. My I, but where is my I? I am not here. I am not now. My I is in my money. I've invested so much of my I in my money. It's terrible. Just terrible. It's tragic. I probably told you this story, but I'm going to tell you again. And I'll make up new things about it. But I was doing this fundraising in Cleveland. And I was trying to meet with this very wealthy woman. And someone organized a meeting. We had lunch together. At lunch, and of course the point is I'm going to take out my brochure and I'm going to show it to her and I'm going to make a little pitch, scholarships and all that. And we're sitting and she's taking me out to lunch and she's got her daughter-in-law and this friend who was kind of the mutual friend that made the connection. And we're having lunch and then she said, "So, Rabbi, what do you do?" So I said, "Oh," and I was, you know, I took out my briefcase and I took out my Israelite brochure that I had personally worked on for hours, not only the writing, but the photography, overseeing the photography, overseeing the printing. I had put so much time in it. And I said, "Well, this is our brochure." And she took it with two hands like it was a piece of toilet paper. And she said, "Rabbi, I have seen so many of these. Please," she lays it on the table, "please, just tell me what you do." Right? Imagine. There goes one piece of my persona. So I said, "Okay," so I start telling her this thing, and she isn't even listening. She is already writing a check. Right? She's not even listening to me. While I'm talking, she's rummaging through her bag, her purse, to get a checkbook, and everything is so dramatic. She opens up the checkbook, she takes out her little pen, she does one of these, you know, I don't know if you ever saw Jackie Gleason, there was, I put my little, it was a very dramatic thing. She's gonna write this check, and she says, and she announces to me and to the people sitting there, she says, "Rabbi, I don't know why I'm doing this, but why not?" Then she writes this check. Now in fundraising, this is what you do. You never look at the check. You take the check, you fold it up, you put it in your pocket, and you thank them. Right? And that's all. So I didn't look at it, right? And then you go to the bathroom and look at it. Now, so what happens is, so I thanked her from the bottom of my heart, and I said, "Boy, I don't want to do this anymore, and I don't want to meet this lady anymore," and, you know. Okay. Anyways, 2 days later, I get a phone call that this woman has decided to host a fundraiser at her home. And I can't understand this, you know. Okay, I said, "Great." So we have this big fundraiser at the home, and what a home. What are we talking about? Actually, we'll call it a house. What a house. It's huge. You know, everything is unbelievable. And there's all these people there, and they hired caterers, and there was such an incredible spread, and there were waiters with white gloves and the whole shtick. I was really getting excited. They were really, you know, they were going to do it all the way with this whole thing. Okay, fine. I give this class about education and the whole deal. And the guy who I was most interested in that evening was the man of the house, because he's really the man who's got this huge foundation, could really, you know, he could write a check easily that could keep us going for a year, this guy. And the guy can't sit for a second. And I'm taking it really personal, like, what am I doing wrong? He sits down in front of me, then before I haven't gotten maybe past three sentences, he's up, he's sitting somewhere else. Three more sentences, he's up, he's right corner of the room. Three more sentences, and he leaves. Leaves. Then comes back and standing in the doorway of his office. And he goes back, and I figure I blew it. What can I do? Well, after the class, a number of people came up to me, and they crowd around me and start asking me questions about it. And before I know it, this man barges in the middle of the crowd, holding my brochure with a check sticking out of it, and says, "Here, Rabbi!" Now, I said, you know, actually, I know he meant well. He wanted to kick the stage off. Someone's got to write the first check, show people that I'm making this donation. But it was very, very embarrassing. And other people didn't get the hint anyways. They just felt like, what is this guy doing? All right, fine. At the end of the evening, the conversation developed to a much higher, sophisticated level of how much was the new swimming pool. And he said, I calculated that if I, God willing, swim in the swimming pool for the next 10 years, and I swim in it every morning, and I do about, 10 lengths, and out of 10 lengths, you've got about 50 strokes, then every stroke will cost me about a quarter. Like, I don't know if he was joking or what it was, because I didn't think that was funny, you know? All right, well, I said, bye-bye, thank you very much. And I got out, and we got into the car, and it was pouring rain. And as I go into the car, this guy walks out of his house without a jacket and starts walking down the street in the pouring rain. I said, where's this guy going? And the woman who set this whole thing up and made the introduction said to me, poor man. Beg your pardon? Poor man. What's so poor about him? Don't you see he can't sit for a second? Didn't you see he couldn't even listen to your class? Look at him now. He's mad. He walks in the rain. He doesn't sleep at nights. I realize what a poor man. Where are you? Where are you? And so, this is exile. Where is myself? If myself isn't here, I can't sit down. If myself isn't here, I can't even sleep. Myself is in the office. Myself is in the stock room. Myself is in the... Where am I? Where am I? And so, my I could be in exile. My I is there. It's in the hands of other people. It's in a car. His meditation would therefore entail reclaiming his I. You have to reclaim your I. Take back your eye. By directing his consciousness to its divine source, the way I take back my eye is by plugging it into the ultimate eye, the divine, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I, God, am your God. All right. Now I want you to turn over here, this long piece here. We're going to read it real quick. This is a piece from a book called What We May Be. A student of mine gave it to me, and I think some of my best books that would be very helpful of being students giving me books, because some of the things they heard here remind them of some of the things that they had learned in other places. And this is a very interesting book. It's based on something called psychosynthesis. Psychosynthesis was developed by an Italian, a Jewish fellow. I cannot pronounce his name ever. Maybe someone can help me. His name is Assia Jolly, something like that. And he was actually a contemporary of Freud. And whereas Freud went in the direction of psychoanalysis, this is called psychosynthesis, right? Psychosynthesis. What's psychosynthesis all about? So this is a book about psychosynthesis. It's not written by Assia Jolly, but it's based on his ideas, all right? So we're going to read it really quickly. Because what he says here is what the Kabbalah has been talking about, what so much of Judaism is based on, and the language whereby it's written is very helpful. Aware of its central importance, psychologists have attempted various descriptions of self, sometimes called the ego. It is being as the executive function of personality, as the coordinator of behavior, as the meeting place of consciousness and unconsciousness, as a constellation of attitudes and feelings, and we're trying to figure out what the self is. Still others describe the self as a result of our interaction with others, as the whole psychophysical organism, or as an illusory aggregate of transient elements. What is the self? People are trying to figure it out. What is the self? Psychosynthesis brings the matter to a point of extreme simplicity, seeing the self as the most elementary and distinctive part of our being. In other words, its core. Okay, your core. We call it the soul. They call it the core. This core is an entirely different nature from all elements. Physical sensation, feelings, thoughts, and so on. The core is not your physical sensations, it's not your feelings, you're not your thoughts, you're not your feelings. They make up a personality. As a consequence, it can act as a unifying center, directing these elements and bringing them into unity of an organic whole. So the self, which is the core, which we call the soul, is not your feelings, it's not your thoughts, it's the you that's feeling those thoughts. No, it's you that's feeling those feelings, it's you that's thinking those thoughts, but you're not those thoughts. But that you is at the command. How are you going to organize those feelings? What are you going to do with those feelings? Right? Seeing this perspective, the self not only differentiates us from other human beings, but it also differentiates ourselves from our ever-changing content of consciousness. What saved David, not me, he has this patient called David. What saved David from his deep fear was the realization that his essence or his self did not coincide with it. He as a self could step back or disidentify from that fear and observe it something other than himself. The fear could be seen out there, so to speak, becoming merely another psychological object, which is our clear contours. His suggestion, by the way, is if you have a fear, you should imagine it. You should even give it a name. You know? Give a picture to your fear. Like, you've got this fear, imagine your fear as a monster, imagine your fear as a dog, whatever. But his point is to try and disidentify yourself and don't become your fear, but look at your fear. And if you can look at your fear, then you realize you are not your fear is not you, and then you could start controlling it. You could start directing it. But if you cannot get to that distinction, then you are trapped by your fear. Alright? The self can also be defined as the only part of us which remains forever the same. It is the sameness which once found and fully experienced acts as an ever-present pivot point for the rest of the personality, in a stronghold to which we can always refer in order to regain a sense of poise and self-consistency. You know what would be very helpful in this? Get a picture of yourself when you were 5 years old and ask yourself, is that me? Is that me? Get a picture of yourself with ice cream drooling down your face, chocolate all over you, right? And say to yourself, is that me? The I has been playing this character all along. If not, I've died. Every birthday is death day because every year I'm a different. I'm so different than when I was when I was a five-year-old kid. You know? So what is that pivot self, that never-changing self, which somehow animates that ever-changing persona? Right? So it's that inner pivot point, which is the soul, then we can see that the self remains the same in ecstasy and despair and peace and turmoil and pain and pleasure and victory and defeat. As Targo poorly put it, the same sun is newly born in new lands in a ring of endless dawns. Myself is there in pain. Myself is there in joy. Don't lose yourself in the joy. And don't lose yourself in the pain. Because if you do, you'll lose yourself. You're not anchored. Sure enough, if we take a look at our psychophysical organism, our first impression is that there is no such pivot point, that everything is in a state of continual flux. To begin with, our body is sometimes tired, sometimes full of energy, healthy, ill, young, old, sleepy, awake, full of energy, healthy, ill, young, okay, hungry, satisfied. It certainly isn't an immutable reality. Our feelings are not permanent either. Through some mysterious illusion, they sometimes assume a character of changeless presence. This is what I have warned almost everybody that I've talked to. When you're feeling good, you generally think you've been feeling good all the time, and that you're always going to feel good. When you're down, you feel like you've always been down, or you've mostly been down, and you're going to continue to be down. When you're up, you feel like, ah, I'm up. And one of the problems and the illusions of doing a program like this is after 3 weeks, some people feel really strong and together and a lot of consciousness, and they feel, now I'm ready to go out there in the world, and I'm going to take on the world, and I'm going to be a much more centered, grounded self. I'm going to be the self. I'm not going to have this extraneous persona, and I'm going to be, 3 weeks, in contrast to 24 years of my life. People are just not realistic. That's what happens. So it's a very dangerous thing because the self identifies with the mood and thinks it is the mood. I am happy. rather than I am feeling happy right now, but I remember feeling sad at other times. I am strong. No, I'm feeling strong right now, but there will be many times where I was feeling weak. And my true inner strength will be when my soul, when I am I. Okay. So through some mysterious illusion, they sometimes assume a character of changeless presence. But then they disappear and other feelings take their place, bringing with them the same old illusions of permanence. Right? Finally, our thoughts are not permanent. They pop in and out of our minds, one after another, in a matter of moments. Yet if we look within ourselves carefully enough, we will find that there is a permanent element. There is something permanent. It's the self. Body sensations change, feelings fade, thoughts flow by, but someone remains to experience this flow. Who is the someone that experiences the sadness? Who is the someone that experiences the happiness? It's you. The self, the soul. This someone is the self, the experiencer. It can be said then that the self is consciousness in its essential state, undiluted, chemically pure. It is a state of psychological nudity in which we have taken off all our psychological clothes. Psychological clothes. Thoughts, feelings, images, physical sensations are only, and only pure being remains. Pure being, soul. The rest is clothes, garments. Remember I told you, attributes are called midot, which is connected to the idea of clothing in Judaism. Madaim is a uniform. Same word. The way things usually work, this pure consciousness spontaneously takes the form of whatever it comes in contact with. If I'm glad, my consciousness is my gladness. If I have a toothache, my consciousness is my toothache. If I think of ice cream, my consciousness is the thought of ice cream. This process we call identification. And it's present in all of us. With training, it's possible to detach our consciousness from the state that mold it. This identification, to experience it devoid of any content or support. Self-identification. All right? So you've got to go through a process of disidentification, which if you look at Arya Kaplan, that's what he said, to disengage from our outer trappings. That's what the Kabbalah said a long time ago. That's what you got to do. To disengage from your outer trappings. Identification can be equated with a loss, a dream, an illusion. We identify with our feelings, our desires, with our opinions, with our roles, with our body. See, if you identify with your opinion, you think you are your opinion, you can't take criticism. Right? If I say, I disagree with that idea. You think I'm disagreeing with you. I'm disagreeing with your idea. Right? That's all. But people become their opinions rather than have an opinion. And then they can't look at it objectively. They can't even change it because they become it. And so, let's start at that paragraph. Identification can be equated with a loss of dream or illusions. We identify with our feelings and our desires, with our opinions, with our roles, with our body. The problem is that if, for example, I identify with an idea which I particularly cherish and believe to be true, and then that idea is proved to be wrong, I feel that I am wrong. If my body is the focus of my attention, the source of my power and success, I perceive myself primarily as a body. Then when my body becomes weak, sick, or old, I feel weak, sick, or old. If I equate my identity with my role, I'm a businessman, I'm a teacher, I'm a wife, then when that role ceases to be, I also feel that my sense of being is diminished or null. If I experience myself as the desire is frustrated, I am frustrated. Right? You see this? There's one thing he's missing, right, which we'll get to in a second. Yes, Heather?
I have a hard time understanding why an idea isn't part of our soul.
Because it's not my soul. I have an idea. My idea is, I don't know, so-and-so is politically wrong. That's an idea, right? And then all of a sudden I find out that I was wrong. That drives me nuts. I won't accept it. Why? Because I feel that if my idea is shot down, then I've been shot down. Because I became my idea. I have an idea. I believe in this idea, but I am not my idea. And therefore, I'm free to have a conversation. Not only that, but in terms of understanding other people, how can we be genuinely tolerant, which is what we're going to be talking about this afternoon, the last class that I'll be giving for this session, will be about tolerance, right? How can I get into your head? The old tradition says that don't judge another person until you're in their shoes, until you're in their place. How can I get into your head? I can get into your head, right? Because my eye is not bound up with my head. You can get a sense of how that person thinks that way. If you become locked into your opinion, you can't entertain the possibility of any other opinions. Because you are this opinion. There is no freelance you that can explore other opinions because you have become locked and imprisoned into an opinion. And that's where fanaticism comes from. Right? You become your opinion. You become your perspective. Rather than you have your perspective, you believe in it. But you can entertain the possibility that other people don't have that perspective. Right? So you can't become your idea. So what happens is this. Since all the contents of consciousness change at some moment, and at some moment inevitably cease to be, identification with any of them inevitably leads to a death of some kind. On the other hand, identification with the self leads to the experience of our permanent being, that unconditioned core which remains the same throughout all of life's events. One woman put it, when I say I am, I know that I am before thinking, before feeling, before acting, I'm aware of pure possibility. Now this, what this woman said, is so interesting. Because, and this fellow astrology has a meditation that he suggests people do, which is a very powerful meditation. He says, you know, when you're meditating, sit, feel the sensations of your body. Your back against the back of the chair, your feet on the floor, right? Get in touch with that. And then he says, say, I have feelings. I have feelings. And just be aware of those feelings, you know, any physical sensations that are going on at that moment. And then say, I am not my feelings. Then he says to go to the next level, get in touch with your emotions. What do you, you know, I'm frustrated right now, I'm anxious right now. Just get in touch with what you're feeling on an emotional level. And say, I have emotions. I have emotions. I am not my emotions. And then he says, okay, now go up. Get into your thoughts. Watch your thoughts. And say, I have thoughts. I have thoughts. I am not my thoughts. And then he says, and the highest place you'll get to is where you'll say, I am. But I realized what he was doing was what the Torah talks about. Because when Moses said to God, what is your name? God says, we're going to take these people out of Egypt. Right? Go down there and tell them God has spoken, it's going to take them out of Egypt. He says, well, what if they ask me your name? What should I say to them? God said, tell them I am that I am. Who is God? The I am that I am, the realm of pure possibility, free will, that ultimate primordial, pure reality, the I am that I am. And my I am is a spark of that one eternal I am that I am. So if I am my thought, if I am my feeling, if I am my body, then I am not I am that I am. But when a person can get to a point of consciousness where they are able to say, I am that I am, then they are able to control their body better. They're able to control their feelings better because they are the master and they are not the victim of their personality. And that's really powerful. You become pure possibility. You've plugged into free will. Right? Now I want to at this point tell you what's wrong with this whole thing. Where I disagree with this guy. I feel he's missing a step. And that's the step that Arya Kaplan said. How do I recapture my eye? There are two steps that Arya Kaplan said you have to do according to the Kabbalah. You have to disengage from the outer trappings. And the way you do that is by directing your eye to the divine source. And this guy's not saying that. This guy is telling you to free yourself from the outer trappings, but then what? Then I'm floating in midair. If you don't give me religion, if you don't give me God, if you don't give me a mitzvah, some way that I can anchor my eye. Because I am that I am is not true. Because the truth is, I am that I am because He is. And if there isn't an eternal I am, an ultimate consciousness that was, is, will be, that has created us all, so I am that I'm nothing. Right? And we talked about that, you know, when we did Rav Soloveitchik's article, right? I think, therefore I am. Judaism says no. Right? I think, therefore I am. No. But God thinks, therefore I am. God is, therefore I am. Right? If God wasn't, then what am I? Nothing. What eternity? Why should I intuit some immortality to me? Why should I intuit some incredible sense of connectedness to a greater whole? Why would I even seek to experience such a reality, such an experience? And so this is where I feel, and maybe I'm misunderstanding him, maybe he would agree with Judaism on that level, but I feel this is the danger of this. The danger of this, and certain other forms of this kind of meditation, of which is releasing the I from the persona, is that, well then my I's really in trouble. Now I'm floating in outer space. Where will I be? And this is what Judaism talks about, the difference between getting out of Egypt and going to Sinai. Right? And there's a very nice book from Eric Fromm called Escape from Freedom. And in it he talks about, and I mentioned to you that Eric Fromm has a lot of Jewish background. He talks about how there's a difference between freedom from and freedom to. I might be free from being victimized by somebody else. Free from having to enslave myself to your goals, your interest. But am I free to be me? Getting out of Egypt was freedom from slavery from Paro. But that doesn't mean I'm free to affirm myself. What is, who is myself? What is the eternal ground and root of myself? How can I plug into my ultimate self? That is getting the Torah at Sinai. Right? And that's what I feel some of these psychological paths do not offer. The next step after psychology is an authentic religion, which is to bind my I. I've released it from the imprisonment of the little I to the persona. But if that I is not somewhat anchored into the great self, the greater self, which Rav Soloveitchik used the terminology, the greater self, the higher self, then what am I going to do? I'll just be blowing in the wind. Then I'm nothing. And that's where I feel this kind of misses. The look in the eyes of a newborn baby can remind us of the same openness to all possibilities. An openness unobstructed by any past experience, without veils, without thoughts, without exclusions. It's true, when you look at a baby, you feel pure possibility. Similarly, the unbound nature of the self makes it the place in the human being where freedom is maximized. But this is what I cannot accept. That freedom is not just simply not being trapped. It's being able to assert myself. But what is myself at that point? Before, I thought myself was my money, my career, my actions, my feelings. You take that away from me and you don't give me another source of identification. In other words, what this man is talking about is there's a problem. The self identifies with the persona. What you need to do to free yourself is to disidentify with the persona. But then I have to identify with the I, because then I'm nothing, then I have no identity. Right? I have no identity. As long as we identify with sensations, feelings, desires, thoughts, it's as if our sense of being were sewed onto us. And therefore they can submerge us, control us, limit our perception of the world, block the availability of all other feelings, sensations, desires, and opinions. On the other hand, when we are identified with ourselves, it is easier for us to observe, regulate, direct, transcend any of our contents of consciousness because we are disidentified from them. But there's something missing here. There's something missing here. And in my opinion, from a Jewish point of view, it's that next step called mitzvah. Because mitzvah is an opportunity to enter into covenant with God. Covenant is this bonding, it's this togetherness, it's this identification. By identification with that which is eternal and transcendental. Now look at this diagram here, it's actually quite good. The first diagram at the top of the page says figure 3. So the first diagram, number 1, which is on your left hand, that's the point is the I. Right? The point is the I. The next thing on the left hand side is to get the I not into one of the sensations. Let's just read it. Empty circles indicate content of consciousness, feelings, sensations, ideas, and so on. The point indicates the self. The self passes unintentionally from identification to identification without the day. Throughout the day, I'm angry, I'm tired, I'm happy, I'm this, I'm that. Right? It is possible to experience the self as a pure consciousness apart from any content, I am. That's the experience, the I am-ness experience. From this psychological place, the self has a panoramic view of all the personality contents instead of being identified with just one. Now you're on top of it. You're watching the anger. You're watching the happy. You're watching it. You're not... All right. Now, of course, people say, well, that's so Platonic. And where's life? He then says, in the psychosynthetic conception, the self is neither the passive spectator extraneous to the show nor the actor completely involved in it. It is the producer, who stages the whole show with expertise, good timing, and tactful handling of the actors. Meaning, once you can get out of the character, you're free to be in and out of the character. And therefore, you're on top of it. But this is only part of the journey. Judaism would say, it's not going to work. If you disidentify yourself with your feelings, with your thoughts, and this and that, and you don't identify yourself with the subject, the ultimate subject, the ultimate consciousness, the source of all consciousness, which we call God, you'll be blowing in the wind. You'll be blowing in the wind. Pardon? Well, he says, once you are able to get out of the sensations, the feelings, the thoughts, and be a spectator, then you can be both a spectator and the actor. You can be both in the play and out of the play, and you won't get lost in your part. But I don't believe that's possible unless you are anchored. Judaism doesn't believe it's possible. Right? Now, what we're talking about here is one of the deepest teachings of Judaism, which is a meditation that the Kabbalah tells us to do before we do a mitzvah. The meditation is L'shem Yichud Kucha Brichu V'Shechintei L'yachid Yudhei V'Vavhei V'Yichidah Shalim. For the purpose, before I put on my tefillin, before I light Shabbos candles, I say, for the purpose of unifying the Shekhinah with the Kucha Brichu. What's the Shekhinah? The Shekhinah is the divine within ourselves, the I, right? And the Kucha Brichu, so to speak, the Holy One, there's a divine presence in the Holy One. One God, different manifestations. This God is so manifest within me, the I, that I could be in exile. But the Shekhinah divine presence is that pure, undiluted center of consciousness, the soul, the spark of God. That's the divine within. And then there's the transcendental, the divine without, the higher, greater self. When I do a mitzvah, the Ari says, and the Ari, who is one of the great leaders of Kabbalah, he's so strong that he says, if you don't say this, it's almost, or at least know this, almost if you didn't do the mitzvah. Because you have to understand what you're doing here. What you're doing when you do a mitzvah is, you're saying, I'm going to unify my I with the transcendental I. How so? Because I will make your will my will. Right? You want me to do this? I'm going to do this, and we bond through this will. And that's what happens. That's the identification. Every mitzvah is an act of identifying with the divine. And in so doing, one is transformed. I am no longer a servant, a slave to persona and situations, if a person succeeds in doing it. I'm not saying this is so easy. But I just want you to understand, spiritually, when we talk about mitzvot, we're not talking about good boy points. You know, like I think I once mentioned to a group of you, I was dating this woman and I was asking her what her image of her home would be like. You know, kind of dream with me. And she said, well, I have a sense of the kids coming home. I think the image that comes to my mind is a refrigerator. And on the refrigerator is this mitzvah chart. You know, commandments chart. Every time the kid does a mitzvah, we put a star. And that was the image that came to her mind. She kind of noticed on my face a certain disappointment. You know, like, yuck. No, but like, certain disappointment. And she thought, well, what's wrong? What's your image? So I don't know, when I think of my home, all I think of, what comes to my mind is light. I just want my home to be so full of light. And she said, well, that'll run a pretty high electrical bill. Right? Cynically. And I said, you're right. And we're finished. You know? But I realized that, you know, some people, even as they evolve, they still have this image I'm not saying there aren't these metaphors in Judaism of points and the scale and tipping the scales. These are very important metaphors, but they are metaphors nonetheless. A mitzvah is its own reward. A mitzvah is an existential experience. A mitzvah is an act that I do, which is to identify my soul with the source of all soul. And the fulfillment, the reward of it, is it. Right? The reward of celebrating Shabbat is Shabbat. A lifestyle that revolves around the celebration of Shabbat is a very different kind of lifestyle. Right? The quality of life is completely transformed. I'm letting go of my business. I'm letting go of my money. I'm letting go of technology. I'm sitting with my family for the sake of being with my family. And that's all. I'm sitting there with God for the sake of sitting there with God. I'm just singing my soul out. And so, I want you to understand that the Judaism that maybe some of you were raised with, that was good when we were 5 years old. How else could they have explained it to us? But now that we're much older, we need to understand that Judaism is a very rich, very deep, transformative lifestyle that brings such treasure, such consciousness, such awareness to life. Right? Let's look at this bottom part here. This is from Abraham Abulafi, who was a 13th century Kabbalist. I just wanted to bring this down because it, you know, kind of parallels what this psychologist says. All the inner forces and the hidden souls in man are differentiated in the bodies. It's the body that differentiates us, because in a certain higher place, we will enjoin in ourselves, so to speak. It is, however, in the nature of them that when their knots are untied, he calls it untying the knots, right? He called it disidentification. The psychologist, Arya Kaplan, Rabbi Arya Kaplan, called it disengaging. It's the same idea. To untie the knots, they return to their origin, which is one without any duality and which comprises all the multiplicity. The untying of the knots of the souls means their liberations from the fetters of finitude, so that they will return to their origin, which is the infinite one. When a person dies, if they're ready to die, then they will return to the infinite one. And they will have even greater consciousness. They will experience not only I am, they will experience the ultimate I am that I am. But a person who has invested their soul in their body, so much so that they have severed their identification with the ultimate greater self, they will die. Right? They will die. The way I live my life determines the way I will die. And whether my death will be death, the end, or whether death will be the beginning. There was a fellow who had lost his son, and he was broken, as I'm sure any father would be broken. And he came to Rabbi Aryeh Levine, a great tzaddik, great, great holy man. There's a book called A Righteous Man in Our Times, fantastic book about this man. He came to Rav Aryeh Levine, and Rav Aryeh looked at him and said, you know, when a baby is born, the baby's crying, but the parents and the family and the friends are singing with joy and saying, Mazel Tov. How do we know? He said, I'm telling you, when a baby's born, in this world, we're saying Mazel Tov, but the baby's crying. But when a person dies, in this world, we're crying. But in the higher world, there's a jubilous announcement of Mazel Tov. You made it. You're on the other side. You were born. For us, birth, physical birth, is a kind of spiritual death. The soul needs to almost die to get into this world. Right? But from our perspective, it's life. But when a person dies, from our perspective, it's death. From the higher perspective, it's really birth. It's really birth. I'll tell you one last story. Not the last story you're going to hear from me, you can be sure of that, but one for this class. They say a story about two babies who are in the mother's womb. Twins. One's a pessimist, one's an optimist. They don't know. They think this is the world. So the pessimist says to his brother, you know, it's all nice and calm in here, but I'm telling you, this is going to end. It's going to end. We're all going to die. His friend said, no, I don't believe that. I think that after this experience, it's going to be a new experience. A new world. His friend, his brother looks at him, you're so stupid. There's nothing. This is it. And the end is near. You just got to get used to it. Well, they argued this for 9 months. All of a sudden, the woman's water broke. Everything went into havoc. And then all of a sudden, you know? And the pessimist looked at her brother and said, that's it, I told you, the doom is coming, everything's going, goodbye, my brother, goodbye. He says, no, it's going to be all right, don't worry, no, it's over, we're finished. Right? All of a sudden, the pessimist sees his optimistic brother being sucked out of this world. Right? He goes, oh no, goodbye, my brother. Right? And he was in so much pain and anguish that had he listened carefully, right? In fact, actually it says that his brother goes out and he's listening as his brother goes out and he hears his brother screaming, ah! Wah! Wah! He said, that's it, torture is terrible! Right? But what he didn't wait to hear is the mazel tov. The mazel tov. The congratulations of the parents. People are so locked in the way they see things, and the way they've planned their lives, the way their parents have planned their lives. And maybe it was good, maybe it's not. I don't know. I'm not knocking parents. God forbid. But you have to get in touch with who you are. And Judaism claims that it does that. That it really does that. Now, I said that this was connected to Chumash, and it really is. Because if you could just quickly look over this next article, where it says Lights of Holiness. Rav Kook, basing on this theme, talks about a very similar thing. And I am among the exiles. He quotes also the verse of Yechezkel. He also brings down the Zohar. The inner essential eye of each person and of all the community is truly revealed, not only according to its holiness and purity, its supreme might, consumed in pure illumination, a sublime brightness burning within it. There's an inner essential eye. Inner essential eye. Of each person and of the community. Somewhere, so to speak, up this ladder of consciousness, we are all together. We share and participate in a unified self. And that inner essential I, in contrast to a non-essential I, which is the ego, but the essential I, is truly revealed not only according to its holiness, purity. This I is holy and pure, but it's not always revealed that way. Why? We have sinned. Our fathers have. The son of Adam, the first sin, who was estranged from his essence, who heeded the snake and lost himself, could offer no clear answer to the question, where are you? That's what happened in the Garden of Eden. They lost themselves. Rav Kook is giving us a much deeper understanding of what a sin is. A sin isn't something you did because God doesn't want you to do it and smack-a-roo. You're punished. It's much more internal damage that you can imagine. Because a sin means I estrange myself from my essence. Because my I, which is a spark of the great I am, has listened to a snake. And the snake has given me some stupid illusion that in and of myself I have meaning. That I have an independent reality. I seek not to identify with any reality greater than myself. And therefore, what is sin? Estranging myself from myself. Getting trapped in other people's visions of me. Getting trapped of trying to be something I'm not. And therefore, the ultimate moment, so powerful, when man and woman ate of the tree, they hid, they were embarrassed, they were uncomfortable with themselves. And what did God say? God said, Ayeka. Where are you? And there's no more frightening question that we're all going to be asked somewhere along this journey. Where are you? Where are you? And he had no answer. Could offer no clear answer. Because he did not know his own mind, because he had lost his true I-ness by sin of bowing down to an alien God. And so Rav Kook talks about the truth is that all sin is losing oneself. Israel tries to be like the rest of the world. When you try to be what you're not, then you've basically sinned. Because what are you? Who are you? You are a spark of the divine. You are an aspect of a transcendental reality who has created you and has imbued you with an aspect of this divine ultimate self. And your ultimate self is through connecting in that way. And this is it. This is our generation. Generation X, like brand X, that's it. Identity crisis. Identity crisis. What is the solution to identity crisis? Am I my talents? Am I my body? Am I my car? Am I my friends? Am I my opinions? Judaism says, you are because God is, and that the lifestyle of Torah is all directed to, you shall be holy because I am holy. That's what it says in the verse. What does that mean? I'll be holy because you're holy? Yes, because the more you identify with the transcendental, the Holy One, the more you will become holy. As the Midrash says, come close to fire and it will warm you. You yourself will become heat by coming close. So, I hope in some way this has disturbed you enough, confused you enough, to really think. Life is too valuable. A lot of people are coming in and talking to me, and I appreciate it, and very happy people want to. But I hear a reoccurring theme of people rushing their lives, people not really taking the time that they deserve to get in touch with their true self. Who am I? Fulfilling some dream. It's like, you know, the Jewish joke. A woman's walking down the street and she's got two kids in a baby carriage. Someone comes up to her, it's a Jewish woman, comes up to this woman, says to her, to the mother, the Jewish mother, she says, oh, what are their ages? She says, the doctor is 3 years old and the lawyer is 4 years old. Right. And I grew up thinking I am a doctor. Rather than, maybe that's one of the manifestations that I will choose to serve God. But that's really the question. That's really the issue. And life is too valuable to rush it, run ahead. Right? Every stage means something. If it's time to crawl, crawl. If it's time to walk, walk. If it's time to run, run. But the greatest sin is when you're trying to run when you should be working on crawling. Right? Because that's the way you manifest yourself right now.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.